The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this week on Where Did the Road Go, we have in studio with us once again Peter Robbins. How you doing, Peter?
Very well, Soraya, all things considered.
Yeah, you have a little bit of a cold, don't you?
I do.
All right, so we'll bear with you on this one, and thank you for coming out regardless.
Glad to.
Because here in Ithaca, it's a little snowy and not as cold as it has been.
That's true.
But still not the greatest weather.
No.
But better than the negative 15 we were getting last week. I think it's like 25 out or something.
Balmy.
So, since the last time you were here, you went back to the UK to Rendlesham itself. You want to tell people a little bit about that?
Yeah, I did. A few weeks ago, I flew to London and then was picked up by a producer for this particular show. We drove out to Suffolk. We had been back and forth for several months. So many projects that you're approached on simply never happen. Other ones are disappointing. This one was very moving, quite intense, and I think went really well. My co-author and friend Larry Warren drove down from Liverpool, met myself and the production team there, and we filmed for several days on the old RAF Bentwaters airbase, as well as back in the woods and in the farmer's field where the events in question actually happened in December of 1980. Hmm. For me, the most charged part of the shoot was this team had paid a considerable amount of money for full access to the old base. And as we discussed earlier, after more than 25 years of working this case, in one sense or another, I finally was able to get into several of the most compelling and charged locations relative to the events in question. One was the old law enforcement building, where security specialists like Larry checked in before going out on guard duty, received their weapons, and returned them after their shift. And the interior is pretty much gutted now, but it was so extraordinary to think about my now friend going in there, getting his rifle, going out on what he thought was going to be a standard guard shift, and having his life completely turned around after 8 hours. We spent almost a day working in the old weapons storage area, and that is nuclear weapons storage area, of earthen-covered hardened bunkers with huge steel doors weighing tons each. Now, of course, kind of a military ghost town, but with the variable of some grass growing through the cracks, very much like it was back during the day when it held the largest amount of nuclear ordnance, not just in England, but in Europe. And at the time, in complete violation of the United States treaty with the UK. I got to climb the 80-foot observation tower where UFOs were first sighted that night and were observed shining beams of light down into the nuclear weapons storage area.
Like lighthouses normally do.
Yeah, right, exactly. I actually only got up about 70 of the 80 feet because it was 50 or 60 mile an hour winds.
Oh.
And I'm okay with heights, but not if I think I'm going to get blown off it and die.
Yes.
But I could also see very clearly for the first time from above the way that the security zones were set up, with these three areas all barbed wired in. One would have had dogs in it. another where guards could pass, another a free fire zone. And this was quite simply a shoot-to-kill area. At the far end of the weapons storage area was in a way as chilling, if not more chilling, a location, a rather nondescript, boxy little building painted burnt orange, which had been the repository of our biological weapons, which we had at that time and in no uncertain terms. And we went in and explored the place, and, you know, your imagination runs pretty wild when it's informed by the reality of what's hanging in the air in a location like this. And to know that that area contained anthrax, probably plague weapons, other things that could have destroyed, you know, all life on the UK. Anyway, I think it went very well. It will be broadcast on a certain station in a certain country this autumn. And when I'm allowed to talk about it, I'll not only come back and we can review it in some detail, but we can create some visuals for your audience to see, you know, while we discuss it, as well as give them a link so that they can see what I think is going to be an absolutely first-rate show.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I hope so.
Yeah.
So many of these shows go, you know, start out looking like they're going to be great, and then the finished product is some kind of dumbed down,
yeah,
simplified thing that just, you know, you're like, well, what is this?
This really was, it distinguished itself in part by the quality of the questions, and they must have interviewed Larry for at least 12 hours and me for several hours. They had worked up this project for many months. They had read Left at East Gate, other books on the subject, gone in early to do their location shooting and, you know, choose the locations where they wanted to work with us. They were extremely professional from start to finish, a great crew. We were out at 7:30 and, you know, worked until dark. And I think we got a great, great amount of footage for them to work with.
Now you said the base has been sold.
Yes. As I recall, RAF Bentwaters was decommissioned in 1993, thereabouts, maybe 92. And at an appropriate interval thereafter, rather than sell it off piecemeal, and it's a good-sized piece of property, certainly some several hundred acres, they auctioned off the base, and a obviously wealthy local farming family bought it. And over the past 20 years or so has slowly been developing it with two ideas in mind. One is business and small industry. While part of it will always be and have the feel of a military ghost town, these buildings can be repurposed, and a number of these huge hangars are extremely secure, have so much square footage to store, you know, anything really,
right,
given the temperature. And there is a Cold War museum. There's actually a small film company, a cafe, moving and storage, and a number of other small businesses right along the old runway. It's also being used more and more, and appropriately so, for film and television locations, as we did.
Right.
And their offices are now in the old base control tower right on the runway, which is still used as a control tower. You know, they have their own runway there. Well, two. So it really, it was wonderful to be back. And at the same time, there are moments where, you know, you have that feeling you have on a battlefield where it's a very peaceful place and very quiet, but you are caught up in what happened there at one time that changed the lives of everyone involved.
Right.
Yeah.
And you said one of the wine cellar. You said one of the silos, was it?
Well, actually, one of the largest of the nuclear weapons bunkers.
Bunkers, okay.
Has been leased out to a wholesaler that deals in wine. And we were able to get in there with the permission of the lessees. And, you know, it's floor-to-ceiling wine. And you think that it didn't used to be.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And any good experiences while you were there UFO-wise? see anything?
No, but the area continues to have regular UFO activity and sightings, other paranormal stuff that goes on in those woods, and has for an awfully long time, Soraya. As we know, there are certain parts of the world that statistically prove and reprove to simply have higher incidence of UFO sightings and the like, and that's just the way it is. Choose your best theory, but that area in Suffolk, East Anglia, continues to be an area with a more pronounced amount of legitimate, multiply witnessed UFO sightings and events than the surrounding counties, for lack of a more descriptive way of putting it.
Yeah, well, you got like the Skinwalker Ranch out in Utah is one of those areas, and but doesn't that kind of argue against an extraterrestrial theory for these things?
No, I don't think so. It it argues that other intelligences, whomever they are, wherever they come from, either have a pronounced interest in that piece of real estate for one reason or another, or it may be, in the common terminology, a window area that they come and go from, either dimensionally or what have you. At this point, even after all these years in the field, I realize how little I know. And when I hear colleagues of mine talking about hyper-specifics relative to things like this, I just have to shake my head, because no one really knows.
Yeah, yeah. That, I think that's the key. No one really knows. We just have ideas, and some people base, they take pieces of theories and they put them together and they act like, oh, here's the answer.
I think that's well said. The way I see it is they take their beliefs, fears, longings, and present them as empirical fact.
Yes.
When in fact, when they do that, they make the jump from scientific inquiry, even, you know, with a lot of loose ends, to establishing a religion of sorts, because it's all based on belief.
True.
And then they assemble people who, for one reason or another, believe the same thing or support those beliefs, and they become, you know, a clique, a following, and in some cases even a cult.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're just lost, but in their own little way of seeing the reality. We don't know.
The I forgot what I was just going to say. I know what I had. I know what I was going to say. It seems like there's a lot of people who don't understand what scientific means. They think, well, this seems logical to me, thus it's scientific, as opposed to actually using some scientific methodologies to discover this stuff.
It's not as sexy, and it can be boring, and it's time-consuming, and it can be costly. For me, the best example I can give, and I might have discussed this when we discussed the case previously, the location that Larry pointed out to me when we first visited the site of his events in, gosh, February of 88, our first visit there. Last month, I'm sure, was my somewhere between my 20th and my 25th trip back to Great Britain. And certainly, I have been out to that field dozens and dozens and dozens of times. But not the field itself, but the precise spot where his event took place.
Right.
That soil was professionally analyzed. And among other things, what the laboratory was able to establish was, in seed germination tests with affected soil and control samples taken at random in the field, the plants that grew always took longer to mature in the control sample, in the affected sample, and only gave mutant strains of the plant in question. There was an excess of four times the amount of sand-sized grains of metallic particles naturally found in that soil in that affected area, suggesting a very powerful electromagnetic effect. The soil in that area had all but lost its ability to reconstitute properly with water and become mud. Literally, the pH had been blasted out of it somehow. Wow. And for me, the most dramatic aspect was that the silica content in the soil, and remember, we're only 5 or 6 miles from the North Sea at this point, so you'd expect sand in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't sand anymore. It was in an interim form of glass. It had melted.
Mm. So it needs some intense heat to do that.
Yes. To add to that, those original audio cassettes of us literally walking out there for the very first time and Larry reacting to what we were seeing, those have been independently voice stress analyzed twice.
Mm.
Other accounts, military documentation, two maps that Larry did for me, one he did for me and one he gave to me before the fact, located that exact area. Now, that's what we call triangulation. It's the basis of criminal investigation, and that is quality scientific inquiry.
Yes.
That is not something based on something channeled from a 5,000-year-old disembodied spirit, a super-secret contact within the Defense Department or the NSA, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you know, people can channel all they want, and if they can, if that channeled entity can tell us something we don't know that we can then verify,
absolutely,
that's awesome. But
that's a whole
until
thing.
You can do that,
yeah.
I think the only one that ever came close to that was Jane Roberts.
Well, and Edgar Cayce.
And Edgar, I'm sorry, that's true. I always think of Edgar Cayce not as channeling something.
They didn't use the term then. He'd go into trance states.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
give information that was duly recorded for 45 years.
Yeah.
And the rate at which he was able to make these deductions is fascinating. And he was the person who convinced me that the phenomena is real, although highly bastardized and I'm sure as infected with cranks and ne'er-do-wells and fakers as any area could possibly be.
And it's so easy to fake. That's the thing. People want to believe, so they don't look at it critically.
Yeah. Well, Conan Doyle, one of my favorite writers, and Harry Houdini, both in their time, made it their business to expose the kind of seance clique. And at the same time, they both had a very open mind about the beyond and what happens next and this whole reality of this other side.
Yeah, yeah. While we were talking about the scientific level of things, I also find people like the late Lloyd Pye to be kind of odd on that, because on the one hand, he's doing DNA testing on the skull, which is totally scientific.
Yeah.
And when I'm talking to him, he then follows with, well, it's a gray alien skull. And I'm like, well, but you can't, and he didn't seem to really get that that's not scientific. That's a belief. That's a jump.
I couldn't agree with you more, and it's a shame because it makes it so much easier for naysayers and reasonable skeptics
who
want to see quality information to dismiss it. It's kind of the mark, in part, of a less than fully disciplined mind. And let's face it, so many of us in this field are self-trained.
Yes.
And we don't necessarily come from scientific backgrounds. That doesn't mean you can't do quality work, but you have to hold yourself to a very high standard.
And I feel that the DNA testing he was doing was great. It was definitely interesting.
Fascinating.
And I think he just should have left the other stuff out, because as soon as people hear that, as soon as people hear he's saying, well, this is a gray alien skull, they dismiss it. And no scientist is going to take him seriously, no matter what DNA results
he
gets.
And these people are so skittish to start with.
Yeah.
And the ridicule factor is so strong for understandable reasons in that field of endeavor. You know, you don't want to embarrass yourself in front of your, you know, professional community. And it just makes you very gun-shy. In fact, it was the results of some of the DNA testing that was the first thing that made me, for the first time, take seriously the possibility that we're dealing with something wholly other here, knowing about skull binding in different ancient cultures, which could reproduce that elongated skull the same way that, you know, this hideous practice in pre-revolutionary in China of foot binding, which was a nightmare, but it was based on this totally enculturated form of what's beautiful as opposed to what's functional or, you know, what's the proper way to move forward.
Well, I always find the elongated skulls interesting in the fact that so many cultures around the world, you know, practiced it. It seems like it had to have a common core there somewhere, whereas the foot binding was just in China. You know, you don't see that everywhere in the world, but everywhere in the world you see this binding of the skulls.
Yeah.
And I had Brian Forrester on a few weeks ago talking about the DNA analysis, and he's been getting a lot of heat over that because he released preliminary results without anything to back it up. It's interesting.
Yeah.
And he's been, you know, and he tried to be very level-headed about it. You know, he just wanted to release it so people knew something was going on. But he got attacked pretty viciously for it.
Yeah.
Even inside the alternative community.
Yeah. Once again, so many people in, as you say, the alternative community are very sensitive in that they know they're doing work that most of the world regards as highly questionable at best.
Right.
And completely loopy, if not, you know, deranged at the extreme.
Right. So, actually, that leads us very well into Wilhelm Reich and the way he was also marginalized and much worse than marginalized by the end of his end of his life. And I only discovered Reich a few years ago. I had picked up a book, as I was telling you, I picked up The Murder of Christ in a used bookstore because I knew the name Wilhelm Reich because I had come across it before, and it was like a buck, and I said, well, you know, that sounds interesting. I'll pick that up, and I never read it. And a few years ago, I came across a documentary on Reich and was absolutely blown away at the research he was doing and how it connected into so many other things that we know today, both in like Eastern mysticism as well with energy fields and stuff like that, and plasma physics and such seemed to be connected to what he was doing. And you've been involved in with people who knew Reich. Now, did you meet Reich himself?
Oh, no.
Okay, I didn't think so.
I was a child when he died. But the way I came to his work was my first year in university. My roommate found a book of his, in his case, character analysis, and came back from either a Christmas or the Thanksgiving holiday completely on fire about this guy. And I borrowed the book. And I read enough of it to realize, and this was a book that was written coming out of his work with Freud. He was one of the original psychoanalysts coming out of the 1920s, a very close member of Freud's inner circle. And toward the end of his tenure with the psychoanalytic community was Freud's first assistant, and they split in 1929. I read enough of character analysis to realize I was in the presence of a great mind. And the book dates from 32, I think, so it was still the beginning of his career. And again, coming out of the Freudian work rather than energy studies. But I continued to read his work for the next 10 years and slowly built up my library of his writings. Orgonomy, as he named his science, is simply the science of how energy functions, and as such takes us straight across and through the entire horizon of scientific thinking and different disciplines, everything from child raising to cancer formation to how galaxies form to meteorology, from character development to mass movements in politics. And about 10 years after I was introduced to his work, I had this memory return of my childhood sighting of UFOs with my sister Helen, and immediately felt out of my depth. And at that point, in sorting through these things and trying to integrate what we had actually seen, which was nothing ambiguous. It was five silvery white disks in a very precise V-type formation over a neighbor's house in suburban Long Island, about 30 miles east of New York City.
Now, is this something you had forgotten?
I had completely repressed the memory.
Wow.
Completely repressed the memory. It was so shocking to me as an adolescent who grew up, I guess I'd have to say, kind of unconsciously accepting the adult world's take on flying saucers. Mm-hmm. I knew they were fine in the movies I'd see on Saturday at the Fantasy Theater in Rockville Center, which I enjoyed very much, but nothing had ever given me cause to think that it was real. And all of a sudden, here are these round things, metallic. You could see regular detailing around the edge to suggest windows. I saw them actually come in at a very high rate of speed and called my sister's attention to it immediately. And they just hung motionless over the neighbor's house for certainly at least several minutes. It was the most shocking thing I had ever seen.
Now, did Helen remember this?
Helen never forgot it.
Oh,
and
okay.
Almost 14 or so years later, when I brought it up, she really just laughed and she said, you know, not only did I never forget this, but when I'd reflect on it, it would always be something rather than would make me anxious that I felt special about.
Nice.
Now, several things come into play here, and it's worth the tangent before moving into some talk about Reich. I was 14 at the time and just a raging mass of hormones. My sister was 12, and just 12, and still on the cusp of genuine childhood, mm-hmm. with everything that comes with. At 14, my priorities in life were to have some cooler clothes, please God, and Mom, to be as a nerdy, short, bookish, bespectacled little kid who collected rocks and bugs and stamps and coins and was a Boy Scout, to, you know, find a way into the community of the cooler kids.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, to get my hands on one of these mysterious creatures called girls. And I knew well enough that if I ever talked about this in junior high, I would never have this thing called sex in my life. And that was something I was very much looking forward to. And I'm not really kidding. I mean, this was running me at the time. And if there are any 14-year-olds in the audience, you're there, right? Or maybe the equivalent. You're more mature than I was at the time, living a Leave It to Beaver childhood. But I was so intimidated by what I had seen that after going through an initial series of what they weren't running through my mind,
mm-hmm.
and I've come to call that the checklist reaction. And I've interviewed, I'm sure, several hundred people over these decades who have had similar things. And at the end, you just hit the wall. And all of a sudden, I realize I am confronting something that nothing has ever prepared me for, that made me feel kind of almost a cosmic loneliness, where Helen felt a deep connection with whatever they represented. And you might ask, all those years later, when the memory came roaring back, and I called my sister that afternoon, and we discussed it for the first time without my feeding her any information. I really, thankfully, took the time to think out how I was going to approach this with her. And what I ended up doing was setting the scene more than anything. And told her what the weather was like, where we were standing, about what time of day, and she cut me off mid-sentence and said, stop, I know what you're talking about. And then went on to elucidate other things. And that afternoon, my life completely changed. I was already late in my 20s. I was beginning to make my living doing what I had always dreamt of doing, being a painter, an artist in New York City, living that life. And this displaced it. I continued to paint and draw and teach painting as I was doing at the School of Visual Arts, my alma mater, wonderful art school. But something had gone out of it for me, and I resented it more than I could say. And some months later, coming back to where we were when we went off on this tangent, I learned one way or another that a man named Dr. Ellsworth F. Baker was, who was a psychiatrist and a medical orgonomist, namely had gone on beyond his regular psychiatry training to work directly with Wilhelm Reich, and ended up as Reich's first assistant for the last 11 years of his life.
Hmm.
And I certainly knew that Reich had observed UFOs and with the Cloudbuster had engaged them energetically. And I know how crazy that sounds to somebody who is not informed by the actual scientific data, but that this guy was not only alive and well, certainly well in his 70s at the time, but still a practicing medical ergonomist psychiatrist with offices in Red Bank, New Jersey, and on the Upper East Side in Manhattan. And I decided I wanted to meet this man. He had worked with Reich. He might be the only person I had ever met in my life that had. And I assumed that he had been very busy doing what he was doing for years, helping people, and probably not keeping up with UFO studies. And as somebody who was already authority on this, with months of study under my belt, I decided to put together a little dossier for him of articles that I had Xeroxed and some declassified documents. And I found him in the phone book, and I cold called him. Hmm. And very quickly introduced myself and told him why I was calling. He, in turn, said, "Thank you. I'm busy right now. Can you call me back this time next week?" And I did. At which point he said, "Yes, Mr. Robbins, I remember you. I'm busy right now. Can you call me back this time next week?" He did it 6 weeks in a row. Now, I now know two things. He had a patient each time I called, and I was disrupting that session. The second thing was, this is not an uncommon method to establish the sincerity of the desire of a possible patient to see you. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's done in a number of respects in business and in the medical and mental health communities. And after 6 weeks, he said, "I can't see you at about this time next week. This is my address. Be here at such and such a time." And even walking down East 89th Street to East Side Drive, where his office was, rehearsing in my mind my little talk that I was going to give him, I was not prepared for what happened at that meeting, which was nothing less than walking into his waiting room and realizing I know this room because I read Orson Bean, an actor who had been in therapy with him for years, a memoir that he had done about his years in therapy with Baker. And not only was the waiting room just the same, I mean, it was just the same. Every piece of furniture, the paint on the walls, the few pictures. And I had never seen a photo of Dr. Baker. And I guess I expected to see Dr. Reich, who was barrel-chested, in the later years, ruddy, big shock of white hair. And the man who walked out of that room was anything but. He probably weighed 100 pounds soaking wet. He had the most extraordinary face. He's well in his 70s. He was a quarter Cherokee, Canadian national. And my first thought, and I don't mean to mystify him. That was my thought that went through my mind. If Jesus had lived to be 75, this might be what he looked like. There was so much in that face. And you could see he was carrying around so much with him. And he invited me into his office. And I knew, when I walked in, gee, that's the chaise lounge that Reich gave him. Mm. And it was very bare. And he sat at his desk. I sat at the other side. And he said, "Why are you here?" Quote, unquote. Well, I knew why I was there. I had worked out my whole thing. I gave him my 9x12 envelope and gave him my little talk. And I was ready to shake hands and leave. I had met somebody historic, somebody whose work I admired and respected. I had read quite a bit of his writing by then. And he nodded, and he looked at me, and he said, "Why are you here?" My first thought then was, I thought I just told you that. I realized, we're going deeper now. Okay. And I actually edged into telling him a bit about my sister and my sighting. The fact that it led us to discuss that same day memories that she had of what would now be characterized as an archetype of a UFO-related abduction, and how I was having a lot of trouble integrating this into my everyday reality. and you know that I had gotten involved in this study to try to find out more. And he nodded again, and he looked at me, and he said, "Why are you here?" And at this point, I really felt myself start to unravel, and I was so surprised at what was going on inside of me, just the tremendous turmoil, the upset, a certain amount of confusion, the anxiety that I had been walking around with since this had become part of my life. I mean, I'm not kidding you, Soraya. I'd be walking down East 23rd Street heading to teach my class, and my mind would go into kind of a split screen. I think very filmatically, being a movie lover since kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be myself doing just what I was doing, and on the other side of the screen, I'd be Kevin McCarthy at the end of the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, standing on the highway screaming at anybody who'd listen. They're here already. You're next. And this is not a good way to live your life.
No, it's not.
And I just started to become emotionally completely undone. I just started to cry. And I was really embarrassed because I didn't know why.
Right.
And I couldn't stop. And I just cried for a while. And then I calmed down. And he kind of nodded. And he took out a very small pad. And he had a wonderful handwriting and could write very small. And he looked at me. And he said two words to me, and I felt my life change in a way that I was not really ready for. He said, "Childhood diseases." And I thought, wait a minute. I know what this is. This is the beginning of somebody taking a case history. I didn't come here to go into therapy. And I started to, measles at this age, mumps at this age, tonsillectomy. And then he said, right, you know, lie down. And the next thing I knew, I was having my first session with Dr. Baker. And it quite blew my mind in terms of what was happening to me energetically on the couch there. And by the end of it, I was going through such an extraordinary muscular contraction, I could hardly, you know, get dressed. Mm. I had to lean against the wall. And he said, "I have an opening at this time. If you're interested in being a patient. But I need you to decide," and he gave me a period of time. It was maybe 2 days, because mm-hmm. there are other people that are interested. I had no idea at the time. I learned years later that more than 100 people were, had expressed an interest to have that spot. And I thought, you know, whatever was going to be $60 a session, this is too much money for me. And I've had my experience here. It was fascinating, but I'll be going now. And that night, I did something also very unusual for me. I woke up out of a cold sleep. I sat right up in bed, and I thought, I have to do this. This is an extraordinary opportunity to become more, to explore an area of my life and human existence, and move forward in a way that I never would have had an opportunity to. And so it began. And I was a patient of Dr. Baker's for 6.5 years or so. Now, during that period of time, I worked as a volunteer fundraiser for what became the American College of Orgonomy in Princeton, New Jersey. I met a number of people that Reich had trained or had as students or patients over the years. Interviewed many of them at length, including Dr. Baker over the years. I was invited to observe a Cloudbuster demonstration. I worked in the laboratory replicating a number of his experiments on my own. I continued my reading. And my life changed, and only for the better. And I have to credit those years in part as one of the greatest gifts I ever gave myself. And I think now about some of the things I've been through in my life and whether or not I would have been able to persevere or to stand long periods of high anxiety. For example, certain periods of time over the years of working on Left at East Gate with Larry. I just think it is so important to me. And in that time, my kind of intellectual appreciation of Dr. Wilhelm Reich expanded tremendously and became very visceral. Reich was a man whom nearly everyone loves to hate, simply based on misunderstanding, misrepresentation, fear of the unknown, a great deal of distorted information that's been put forward about him. The fact is that the communists, the Nazis, certain elements of the psychoanalytic community wanted this man quiet at best or dead at worst. And you got to be doing something right to have all those people on your case. To the best of my knowledge, he is the only legitimate, credible scientist who produced extraordinary findings in his work that very few people who attacked him ever bothered to educate themselves to and certainly not replicate, who had his books burned in United States government incinerators. And I don't mean a couple of books. I mean 8 tons of original literature, starting in the throughout the Eisenhower administration and ending, I think, a few weeks before Kennedy took office. I have copies of a number of those original editions that I was able to find at a time when you could still secure copies in the late 70s and into the early 80s. Reich's work forms for me one of the most important scientific bodies of discovery, of findings, not just in the 20th century, but of the past few millennia. And even now, as we sit here talking, the number of people in this world who study it, who take it seriously, who are involved in replicating his experiments and building on his work, is such a tiny percentage of such a tiny percentage of individuals on this earth that if I was not an optimist, you know, I would be distressed about it. I've spoken at Reich conferences in this country, in France, in Greece, and most recently in Rome just this past fall. And every time I do, I am so heartened by the important work that's being done in every area of science by a small cadre of dedicated people, that I always come out recharged, realizing how incredibly fortunate I was to be exposed to his work for the first time when I was still a teenager, and how it's informed my life to this point, changed it only for the better in a very active sense, and given me access to tools to live my life more happily, more full, with more of a spirit of adventure, excitement, with more compassion for the suffering of people than most people I will ever meet in life. Almost the great majority of material that's been published on Reich has been published by detractors and haters, many of whom have never read his original work or read such small, selected, excerpted parts that they are able to pick it to death and intellectually feel superior for one tiny point, which is part of human nature when you're afraid. However, if you were to go online and start searching for used books of Reich's, because literally nothing is in print at the moment, you'd find that there are probably at least 20 books that he wrote that are available in on everything from, you know, human behavior to child raising to fascism to cancer formation to meteorology and on and on and on down the great scientific pantheon. Plus the fact that he was such a prolific writer that when he died in prison on a technicality that the state of Maine, not to its credit, although it is very different than it was then, that you know, they essentially murdered him without pulling the trigger.
Right.
To put a man like this, so ferociously dedicated to human freedom and in such deep contact with nature, into a stone and steel prison cell was the equivalent of killing him, especially given the fact that he had high blood pressure, was a chain smoker to some degree, you know, not very careful about what he ate. It just crushed him in many respects. However, the legacy that he left is extraordinary, and it is still coming out. He certainly had enough perception of people's lack of ability to move forward and grasp this work, probably most loaded of all around human sexuality and the nature of blocked sexual energy and the neuroses that runs the world and destroys most people's lives, at least. It hurts them so badly at the heart of the possibility of having a really open, loving, ecstatic sex life, love life, that part of his will stipulated that his unpublished work be put in a vault for 50 years. And he died in 57. So in 2007, that vault, which is in Portland, Maine, was open. And the amount of unpublished writing they found was overwhelming. It was, I'm trying to remember the stats, but I think it was over 50,000 pages.
Wow.
And the executor of the estate is now at a very advanced age. I don't know even if she is still working at it or who will move into that role. Funds are limited, but for decades to come, decades and decades to come, we have the potential of more and more work from him coming out of the past that is still as sharp and fresh and important as the day it was written.
Oh. Okay, we got to take a quick 45-second break. We'll be right back with Peter Robbins.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we've been talking with Peter Robbins tonight about his own UFO experiences, his return trip to Rendlesham, and most recently here, Wilhelm Reich, and how he got involved in studying Wilhelm's stuff. He's done a bunch of lectures on him. And Reich is a very complex individual. His work was really complex, and there was a lot to it, and it affected so many areas. And you mentioned at the right before we took the break, sexuality, and that seems to be the thing that really bothered people at the time, is that he so openly talked about sexuality in a time where that was not okay. And even today, it seems to make people uncomfortable. If you bring up sexual, like, violence is fine, but sexuality, you can't get into that.
Well, pornography is fine too, but not open, loving sexuality. And it's not just in the day, no matter how sophisticated, you know, us moderns feel in this great free country that we live in some respects, you know, we're still clamped down around this like crazy, and at effect of the mythologies, the legends, the myths that we grew up with, our religious training, the example our parents set for us, romantic disappointments, etc. Probably a good idea to give just sort of a brief overview of his life. He was born in 1897 in the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. His father was a civil servant. His mother, a very sensitive woman, an artist and a pianist. He and his younger brother, Robert, were privately educated by tutors on the family estate. And a major crisis in his life occurred when he was still a teenager. He came upon his mother in flagrato, as they say, with a man she loved very much. I think her piano mentor.
Mm.
And was so shocked, thrown, upset by the what he had seen, that he told his father. His father, from everything I've read and deduced, was a perfect example of sort of a Prussian, tightly wound, very rigid, martinet kind of guy, who confronted his wife, as one would, and essentially crushed her spirit to such a degree that she simply died. His father was then consumed by such guilt that he stood out in a storm, developed pneumonia, and he died. And great. Mike, you know, he's like 17 years old.
Right.
He's carrying around this guilt. Then everything changes with a little something called World War I. Reich joins the Austrian army, becomes a he was an officer, an artillery officer.
Oh, okay.
Served with distinction in the Austrian army. At the end of the war, you know, Europe lay in waste. The family estate had vaporized. There was no money, no property. But this brilliant young man decided that he wanted a career in medicine and made his way to Vienna and paid for his medical school training as a tutor to other students. Now, you couldn't be in Vienna in the early 1920s without being aware of this extraordinary, radical, unheard-of work being done by this Dr. Freud.
Mm-hmm.
And upon graduation, Reich made his way to Freud, presented, and was accepted by Freud to be trained in the early psychoanalytic tradition, and began to practice this under very close observation and contact with Dr. Freud. Now, at the time, from what I understand, reading Reich on Freud, a wonderful book, and about Freud's take on Reich in the Freud archives, that Freud, he admired Reich's intelligence, his commitment, but there was something about him, he was a free thinker and somebody who whose own fierce intelligence determined where they were going. And by 1929, he had worked, I believe, with several hundred patients in the Freudian method. And to digress 90 seconds here, when we think of the Freudian method, the archetype is someone on a chaise lounge or a couch or something.
Right.
With the psychotherapist in a chair taking notes or, you know, with their...
rubbing their chin,
their chin in their hand. And the chair being placed just out of their visual frame of reference.
Right.
Now, that's the method that many Freudians still follow as far as a form. Do you know how that form came to be?
No.
It came to be because Freud felt decidedly uncomfortable having his patients stare in his eye.
Mm.
Huh? That is how that happened.
Interesting.
Reich, among other things, turned the chair around.
Oh.
And he sat close to the patient. And he observed the patient's face, body language, throughout the session. He also began to realize that in the facial expressions, there were certain signals of, you know, feel sorry for me, be compassionate, punish me for being bad, or whatever, whatever. And his way of dealing with this, what a mind, was to simply be a mirror. And if that patient was going into catharsis, he wasn't giving any place to run. The patient was seeing their expressions reflected on their therapist's face, which had the potential of resulting in the patient going into a full catharsis, crying or whatever, and maybe for the first time in the therapeutic, confronting the root issue and then being able to discuss it. Anyway, by 1929, Reich presents to Freud, sets up a meeting, and within this famous meeting, he discusses the fact that after working with 200 and whatever number patients or what have you, in this method that Freud had pioneered, he appreciated that Freud felt that many, if not most, of the neuroses, pathologies, psychoses on occasion, dysfunctions that kept that patient rooted in a place that was unsatisfying were based in their sexuality or lack of it.
Mm-hmm.
And with respect, what Reich presented to Freud was that, in his opinion, even the ones that seem to present themselves as work-related or family-related or whatever, that at the basis of all of these root problems, they had a sexual basis. And this was too much for Freud, who was already Freud, you know, in a very conservative, highly intellectual community, Vienna, with many distinguished patients at this point, in his own probably less than satisfying marriage. I think that's absolutely established. And so they went their own ways. Reich went on briefly for several years to accept the invitation of the Communist Party in Germany and ultimately in the Soviet Union, which still had a little bit of latitude in terms of experimenting or being open to things
mm-hmm.
that were clamped down under not that long after when Stalin assumed and consolidated power.
Right.
And he was invited to set up a series of clinics for workers. They called them, it's a good amalgam of words, sex pole. It had the words sex and pole for politics.
Mm.
Same root word in German as well. And the idea was, you know, a lot of these couples that worked in factories and things, really, you know, they were coming from rigid religious backgrounds and, you know, the whole idea of the great socialist revolution was somehow not being manifested in their intimacy. And what began to happen as he and the therapists that he trained worked with these couples was in the cases where the man and woman could establish what Reich referred to as a meaningful sexual equilibrium, horror of horrors, they began to put their own happiness and the happiness and well-being of their families before the great cause of scientific socialism. Now, this is when the communists booted him out of the party and declared him insane, the same way that when he left Freud, a lot of the people working directly with Freud who felt that Reich had assumed a position that, you know, he was one of Freud's most trusted colleagues, that's when they said he went insane. Why? Because he left Freud. At this point, he begins to establish, he becomes a lifelong anti-communist and anti-fascist, and observes something quite extraordinary. It's referred to in two of his most important early books, People in Trouble, and talk about a book titled The Mass Psychology of Fascism. Mm. Two incredibly important books that people should read today, and they're out there. In these books, looking at this man, Adolf Hitler, who is coming to power and consolidates his power in 1933, and Stalin, this extraordinarily brutal dictator, he observes what he refers to as a common functioning principle, that even though communist repression and national socialist repression have very different looks, the communists affect the look of the people. You know, the leaders dress simply, you know, everybody from Stalin to Mao Zedong, the workers' outfit. But as they say in Animal Farm, you know, some animals are more equal than others.
Right.
Where the Nazis, you can see them coming 10 miles away with their uniforms and their, you know, amazing paraphernalia and their rigid movements. But they're just the same on a certain level. It's about repressing human behavior, controlling the masses. and having them do your bidding. And for this observation, he became someone who both Stalin and Hitler wanted dead. He managed to get out of Germany within a few weeks of Hitler's consolidating power and made his way to Norway, where he took his work into observing the dynamics of cancer formation and how in certain kinds of cancer, energetic therapy, which would increase the individual's tolerance of anxiety, allow them to make contact with the rage they were holding back, which often helped to feed the resignation which was killing them, was observed by scientists in Norway, who is this interloper and this immigrant. And this set off a smear campaign in the Norwegian press, belittling his work and attacking it, a dynamic that followed him all his life. At this point, something extraordinary happened, which was the New School for Social Research in New York City, which is still in existence down in the Village, great school, invited him to emigrate to America to teach there. And so he made his way to America in the early 40s. He found a home in Queens, New York, my home where I was born and not far away, began to practice and refine his therapeutic methodology, which was moving further and further away from intellectual talk therapy to sighing out loud, kicking, moaning, yelling, doing everything to get you out of your head and into your body, where feelings were locked in muscular contractions. And as you were able to break through these things, and I remember it in therapy, it was a remarkable sensation, to make contact with some of what, you know, was holding you back, these memories that were holding you in place,
right,
began to think more about and work more with infants. And moving into the later 40s, began to realize that no matter how much he and the therapists he was training, and with one exception, Dr. Ole Raknes in Norway, all of the therapists he trained, you know, you hear about Reichian therapists. As far as I know, all you need to do to qualify to be a Reichian therapist is to say, "Hi, I'm a Reichian therapist." It doesn't mean anything, really. It means you feel you have some understanding of Reich and his work, and
right,
you
right.
do stuff. Medical ergonomists, of which there are probably now several dozen in the world total, are first psychiatrists before they can even approach, meaning, of course, they're physicians, because sometimes what can be released in a session requires a medical doctor and not just therapist. And then there's years of separate training under somebody who was trained by Reich or Reich himself. By the early 50s, he's realizing that no matter what he does in terms of therapy or what his therapists do, you can't straighten out a bent tree.
Right.
You know, you can give somebody tools to help them through things,
mm-hmm.
but that the future resides in raising healthy children, starting from infancy.
Mm.
And it was enlightening for me, as I educated myself around Reich's work, to see, you said, you know, the first book that you bought of his was The Murder of Christ. And this was not just something he was discussing in actuality. It was more a framework to see what we do to people in this world, what's done to a small baby, what's done to a child, what's done to an adolescent, to squash them, to hurt their ability to feel fully, to experience fully, to live their lives fully, to be of goodwill, to have courage, to be the kind of person who evolves into, and Reich knew this was an ideal state that probably we'll never see on Earth, but if we lived in a world where sexuality was not seen as some bugaboo and something that you've got to repress in your child because you remember how painful it was to you, but as just the most natural human functioning in the world. And you travel to a degree in some countries in this world, Denmark, Sweden to a degree, a handful of others and other cultures, the Trobriand Islanders who have all but disappeared, some of the Pacific island cultures where sexuality is seen as natural functioning and just joyously wonderful part of life, besides for procreation purposes. And Reich envisioned what he called a work democracy of free, emotionally, sexually, intellectually healthy people who live together in harmony because they loved life and they loved being a part of a community of healthy people. And when somebody wasn't healthy, you didn't turn your back on them. This was, you know, as they say, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. This was the person that you helped. This was the person that you supported. This was the person that got the extra love and was carried by the community to a degree. So by the late 40s, the early 50s, Reich's thinking was turning to how the weather forms around the Earth, galactic currents, how star systems form, the birth of suns, this kind of thing. And as careful a study of nature as he was able to do. And at this point, he relocated to rural Maine, found a wonderful property, used the stones from the original farmhouse to build one of the most interesting buildings I've ever been in my life. His home in Maine, which is now the home of the Wilhelm Reich Museum in Rangeley, Maine, wonderful place to visit, open not all year, so you should check ahead, but you can visit their website and wonderful bookstore as well, that it is the most perfectly integrated building in terms of living and work. Mm. You effortlessly move from the living quarters into the library, into the laboratory, into the observatory, into the painting studio, into the medical offices. It's just the most, it's a true expression of the way he thought and worked. And that is where he lived and worked for the rest of his life. And again, the technicality that he was jailed on, and there were people who were working very hard from the post-war years, about 1947 on, to nail him, to crush him, to destroy his reputation and himself. And by 54 or so, I think it was 54, they found the technicality. No patient of his, or no patient of any therapist that he ever trained, ever registered a complaint
right.
with anybody, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Medical Association, the Food and Drug Administration. They were waiting for something. What they did in the meantime was they labeled his medical devices appropriately as experimental devices, and an injunction was set up against interstate shipment of, say, a medical orgone accumulator or what we call a doorbuster, a small simple device that directs energy that can be used for speeding up healing of a burn or a cut or a laceration, speed up the healing of a sore throat, any number of things, make a baby feel calmer. And I've worked with all these devices on and off over the years, replicated some on my own. One of his physicians, in a terrible moment of just not thinking, shipped an orgone energy accumulator, which was a number of flat panels packed up with schematics on reassembling them from Maine, I think, to New York State. And they nailed him on it. Reich, who was out in Arizona at the time, doing an amazing series of tests, field tests with the Cloudbusters. And in fact, by the time he left Arizona, where he was with a team of workers, had broken every existing weather record in the history of Arizona to this day in terms of creating precipitation in an area that had seen maybe 5 inches of rain in 50 years, went back to Maine, decided to take personal responsibility for this, went to court himself and made a terrible decision based on his idealism and, I guess, to a degree, naivete about how our legal system works, and decided he would try to use this trial as a way of presenting the validity of his work. And the judge, who was not unsympathetic to him, would have none of it. And he was convicted on this interstate shipment of an experimental device, and sentenced to a year in Allenwood Federal Penitentiary in Pennsylvania, and was found dead in his cell about 10 days before his scheduled release.
Yeah, which is awful. All right, we're out of time. And that's just the very basics about Reich. So we're going to have you back, and we're going to do a full show on Reich.
That'd be great. And as far as I'm concerned, if this is something that is of interest to your listeners, I'm happy to just continue this as a dialogue with us as our schedules allow. Okay. I would say in closing, because I know we don't have much time left, we don't have any time left, for anybody that's interested in Reich's work and learning more about it from a rational, accurate perspective, if you Google OBRL, Orgone Biophysical Research Laboratory, a wonderful facility in outside of Ashland, Oregon, run by my dear friend and colleague, Dr. James DeMeo, you will have a tremendous amount of information at your hands. The Wilhelm Reich Museum and its bookstore also. The American College of Orgonomy in Princeton, New Jersey, also with the bookstore, very good source. And I'm pleased to say that there is a relatively brand new book out about Dr. Reich, which is about as fine a book on Reich as opposed to by Reich or against Reich that's ever been written. And here it is. It's called In Defense of Wilhelm Reich by Dr. James DeMeo, and I could not recommend it more if I had written it and was making money selling it.
All right. You're on WVBR FM Ithaca. This has been Where Did the Road Go? And we're going to end with a song by your late sister. And do you want to say anything about this?
Yeah. As you know, and a lot of our friends know, my sister Helen was a remarkable singer-songwriter, a brilliant electrifying performer, and part of the nexus of the real origins of the punk music movement and scene in New York, doing her first performances at CBGB's in 1976, working with some of the greats over the years, and she knew them all and worked with them all or shared the stage with them at different points. Her band was, as far as I'm concerned, I'm hardly objective, but I am to a degree, was probably the finest band to not sign the big contract.
Mm.
But anybody who was around at that time knows Helen's work. And what we're going to hear is a song called Destinations Unknown. It was one of the first songs that she wrote and recorded. As I recall the melody, I'll have to double check. This is by our dear friend Albert Bouchard, her most prolific collaborator over almost three decades, and boyfriend twice, drummer in her band, and best known for not only being the legendary drummer of the Blue Oyster Cult, but as the man who, when people say more cowbell, it was Albert's cowbell. So, Destinations Unknown, 1976, early Helen Wheels.
All right, thank you so much, Peter.
Destinations unknown, destinations unknown, destinations unknown, destinations unknown. heart you still exist when I'm lonely as can be. I'll visit you in my memory. If you need me, you will see I'll be with you in all your dreams. Babe, I gotta go and grow. Unknown.